The following message is from Sierra Community Church. To find out more about our church, visit us on the web at sierra.church.
Welcome, Sierra Community Church. Thanks for joining us this morning. I want to tell you, it really is nice having you guys send in your pictures. We've got almost just shy of 300 pictures in here right now, and it's a whole lot nicer seeing your faces than preaching to an empty room. And we'd love, they keep trickling in, and we'd love to have more. So if you have not sent in your picture yet to us to put on these chairs, we'd love to have your addition to it. All you got to do is just email it to me, which is noah@sierra.church, and I'll print it out and get it in here. We'd love to see that. And I think after we all get back together, we'll do something fun with these pictures as well. So I hope that before we started this morning or at some point today, you get a chance to listen to worship. Kristen's put together the worship team, and although they can't be together, they put something together that I hope that you will really take advantage of and enjoy, because it's outstanding. So, all right, glad that you guys are with us this morning. We are still working through the book of John, and we are on part 17, and we're just looking at the life of Jesus according to John, who was one of Jesus's not only closest friends, but he traveled with Jesus through most of his ministry. So you talk about getting a bird's eye view, that's what we're getting from John. So one thing I want to let you know is today we're actually going to celebrate communion together. So this might be a really good opportunity for you to just hit pause on your recorder or whatever you're watching on right now and go grab a cracker or a piece of bread and a cup. And at the conclusion of the service today, we're going to, everything's kind of pointing towards celebrating that Jesus is the bread of life. And so I'll give you a minute to pause and we'll jump back in here in just a minute. All right, we're going to be looking at John chapter 6 here in just a minute, but I want to start actually by playing a video for you. So if you've been paying attention the last couple of weeks, Nick and I have been putting together these short 15-minute interviews with people from our church and also people that are connected to our church. So one of the things we did a couple of weeks ago is we interviewed Kevin Neshaw, who has been running the summer Campus Crusade crew project here in town, and we interviewed him, and I want to play a short clip for you thinking about how I don't think any of us welcome pain or difficulties in our life, but they can play a really profound and helpful role in our life. And so I want you to hear how that worked in Kevin's life.
So Kevin, first of all, how did you get involved in campus ministry?
Yeah, great question. When I was a college student, one of my best friends and teammates drowned in the river that runs through campus. And about 2 months before he died, I actually had an opportunity to share with him about my relationship with God. And he admired my faith, but didn't really want to have anything to do with it. And I think when he passed away, that just had a huge impact on my life. And I remember there was one day I was on campus after he died, probably a couple weeks after he died, and it was kind of between classes, and the sidewalks were just choked with students, moving between classes. And remember, the Lord just stopped me in my tracks, and people were kind of bumping into me, running into me. They're probably like, why is that guy stopping in the middle of the sidewalk? And I just felt like the Lord said, Kevin, look at all these students all around you. There, so many of them are just like your friend Ryan. They think they have their whole life ahead of them, but the reality is, like, it could be gone just like that. And I felt like the Lord said, I want you to give your life to taking the gospel to college students.
Yes, powerful story about how pain and difficulty really, which is a major tragedy, but God used that to help shape or bring about something really amazing in Kevin's life. And that's really where we're going to be going today in our message, just thinking about how God uses pain. And in a funny way, thinking about how God uses hunger. Not just physical hunger, but spiritual hunger to bring about a change in our lives. So like I told you, we're going to be looking at John chapter 6. We're going to look at the first 15 verses in there. One of the things that makes this a really unique story about Jesus feeding the 5,000 is it's actually told in all four of the stories about the life of Jesus that we have in our Bibles. So it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you can see the cross-references where you can find it there in your Bibles as well. And you might think that like a whole bunch of these stories about Jesus would be in each one of the stories about Jesus' life, but believe it or not, it's actually very, very rare. This is a really unique story, and I'll explain to you why as we get into the story this was such a big deal. But I mean, I consider this. Think about like Jesus' birth, right? I mean, that's a big deal, right? But it's actually only, the actual birth event is only recorded in two of the stories that we have about Jesus' life. So, I mean, that just gives you a sense of why and how impactful and profound this story was. There's, for the most part, they weave together seamlessly. There's very little difference, but there are some really unique and neat details if you actually spend the time reading all of them together. So it starts by saying this. It says, sometime after this, and sometimes so John is telling us there's something really important that just previously happened that brought Jesus to this point. And so if you look at the other stories about Jesus' life, a couple of things happen that stick out to you. One big event is we read in the other stories that John the Baptist, who played such a big role in the book of John that we've read so far, because John has been one of the people that's pointed people to say, Jesus is not just another guy, another smart teacher on the block. He really is the person that God has sent. And if you read early on in Jesus' life, he clearly has this connection to John the Baptist. And we read in the other stories that John has been beheaded and killed. And so just before this, in the other stories, we find out that John has died and Jesus finds out about this. And so Jesus is on his way back, we know, from reading in chapter 5 of John, from Jerusalem, going back up to Capernaum. Capernaum is sort of his head base of ministry in the northern part of the country where he lived and worked. And I told you a couple weeks ago that like Capernaum, sort of the Galilee region where Capernaum is, sort of serves as a release valve of pressure. Because if you read in chapter 5, if you've been following along with us, things get really, really heavy. Jesus is in this serious conflict with the religious leaders in Jerusalem. And they don't just want to like send him back out of the city, they want to kill him, right? I mean, it's already to that point. That's how hot and heavy the conflict has gotten. So it's a good thing that Jesus has this time to be able to continue his ministry. And that's part of why he doesn't just stay and live in Jerusalem. This gives him the opportunity to continue to teach people. And so it says this. So Jesus goes back up to the northern part of the country, and it says Jesus crossed from the far shore of the Sea of Galilee. And if you look at a map, I always marvel at this. Every time I look at Galilee, it's amazing how much it looks like Tahoe. And it's like a miniature Tahoe, 13 miles up and down and about 7 miles as the widest point across. And if you look at the map there, you zoom in, you can see where Capernaum is on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. And we know from the other stories where Jesus actually crossed over to with his Bethsaida. And so if it, like as the bird flies, this is like 6 miles. It's not far at all. And if you look at the land map, you're like, well, why does he take a boat across this? Why doesn't he just walk? And if you look at the topographical map, which is why I put this on here, is you can see that really, really dark green area is like a serious marsh. And even today, if you go to Israel, I was amazed by this as we were there this last year driving. We circumnavigated the lake one of the days that we were there. And the north part up there, you can still see today. You did not want to walk from Capernaum up across there because it's a serious marsh. And so it would take people walking at least 9, and in most cases up to 11 or 12 miles to go far enough north to find places that were reasonable to cross over to get to Bethsaida. And if you want to get anywhere else on the east shore, the boat was by far not, it was dangerous, which you'll find out more about next week in our story, but it was by far the most common form of transportation from one side of the lake to the other. So it says, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs that he performed by healing the sick. And then Jesus, when he got there, he went up on a mountain and sat down with his disciples. Now, when it says a large group, you're going to find out in a minute, they counted by counting the heads of families, and it says there's 5,000 people there. That's the low number. It probably flared all the way up to somewhere in the number between 15 and 20,000 people. And this is, you know, this is like a sure sign that Jesus' influence has gone from just being sort of this local, fantastic teacher to all of a sudden everybody in that region wants to see and hear and experience this guy, Jesus. So everybody from the northern part of the country is coming over there. The town that Jesus was born in, just to give you an idea of how big this was, the town that Jesus was born in, archaeologists tell us, is no more at the time of Jesus than probably 200 people. So, I mean, this is no longer just a couple of people hanging out watching Jesus. They are transfixed by this guy's teachings and particularly by the miracles he's performing. Huge, huge deal. If you go over Bethsaida even today, you can see these huge grassy mounds that would have fit an awful lot of people for Jesus' meetings in times like this. Now, verse 4 tells us that the time that this happened was the Passover. You remember back to the beginning of chapter 5, if you were with us paying attention, John talks about when Jesus was in Jerusalem, he says it was for a festival, but it doesn't say exactly what it was. But here, notice, John wants you to know exactly what the time of this event is. And in fact, this is so important because all of chapter 6 really resounds with the echoes of this festival of Passover. And a lot of times it's easy for us to forget what Passover represented to these people. And I'll just briefly remind you, you go back to the book of Exodus and you find where Passover is instituted and why they continued to celebrate it, you know, 1,500 years after it. And even today, it's one of the two major holidays that Jews celebrate around the world. And so if you go back and you look at a map of the world at the time of the Passover, this is when Moses goes down to Egypt to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And that's where the map dot is there in Egypt in the fertile Nile River Valley. And what they did is finally, after all the plagues, Pharaoh said, get out of here. Because God was coming to, what was he doing? He's rescuing his people from oppression and slavery, helping them get a freedom that they could not have gotten on their own, right? That's what Passover is all about. It's God rescuing, intervening in a way that they couldn't help themselves. And the people traveled from there, and it really should not have taken them long, but it took them 40 years because of their grumbling and complaining, their lack of trust. And so God is using this time as a lesson in the hot desert to learn that he really is going to provide for them. He's going to protect them. And he's helping them learn what it means for them to be his people. Because that was God's goal, is that they would represent to the rest of the world what it meant to know God and live for him and his purposes. And so one of the things that God did is in that provision, you remember the people get out there and they're like, we don't have any food. How are we going to survive? And God provides food in several different ways. But one of them is manna, which they called bread from heaven, right? So God provides for them something to be able to feast on. And he provides enough for them to survive all those years in the desert. So all of chapter 6 echoes with this Passover theme of God providing bread to satisfy their hunger. Only it's no longer just physical bread, you'll find out as this chapter goes along. So it goes on to say, in verse 5 it says, So Jesus looked up and he saw this great crowd of people coming towards him, and he said to Philip, and this is one of the cool things about the story in the book of John, is Philip and Andrew, who don't have the interaction with Jesus in the other three stories about Jesus' life, do enter into the story here. And so Jesus asks Philip this question. He says, where shall we buy bread for all these people to eat? You know, I think we read the Bible sometimes and we like sort of, a lot of times we're familiar with the end of the story, so we're like, we don't like really stop and think about, can you imagine what it would have been like to be put on the spot? You've got like 15,000 people there. And Jesus goes, hey, buddy, how do you want to feed these guys? You want to talk about a gulp moment? Like, are you serious? How do you react if you were Philip in this situation? Now, it's interesting. We get this insight as to why Jesus asked this question. In verse 6, he says, Jesus asked this only to test him because Jesus already had in mind what he was going to do. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. When you read this, you kind of go like, why would Jesus do that? Why would Jesus put this guy through this exercise? Why would Jesus test him? And an interesting question along with that is to ask this. Is God's purpose in testing something that was just reserved for his friends that he was traveling with then? Or is it possible that that same purpose that God had in testing Philip, he still might use in yours and my lives today? An interesting question to ask. So he knows, I mean, Jesus, of course he knows what he's going to do. He knows a problem that we can't solve by ourselves, Jesus knows how to take care of. So Philip, anyways, on the spot, answered him. He said, look, he says, you're crazy, dude. He says it would take more than a half a year's wage to buy enough bread for each person to what? Not get satisfied, but just to have one bite. What's he saying? It's just, you're asking something that's impossible here, Jesus. One of the things that, like, when you read the Bible, I hope that you will get in the habit of doing is just slowing down enough to not just read the stories, but allow the stories to read something back into yourself. This, I mean, think about the opportunity that Philip had here, not just in the moment, but to reflect back later on this whole event. To learn something not just about Jesus, but about himself. I think that this story, it poses several really good questions, but one of them I want you to stop and just think about right now, which is, in your life, there are times where we feel totally inadequate to be able to answer some really challenging questions. Sometimes they might come from a work situation, they might come from our spouse or from our kids. It might be financial issues that just come on us because of medical bills or because we lose our job. I mean, there's all these things that happen to us in our lives, and the solution just isn't easy to discover. And I want you to think, how in that moment, how do you react? See, I think it's easy to get down on Philip here and be like, dude, this is Jesus. Why didn't you trust him? Act in faith. Recognize what he's able to do. It's clear instead he's consternated and he's probably frustrated. See, when I was thinking about this story over this last week, I thought about just in my own life, that is my go-to disposition in difficult circumstances and situations that I can't answer. My initial reaction is to go, woe is me. What are you doing here, God? And I go to that place of frustration, boom, so fast. And it's a good opportunity to say, we might say to Philip, go, hey, man, this is Jesus. Why would you trust him? Ask him to work. Believe that he can do Ephesians 3:20. Paul is bragging about God, and he says this, God is able to do immeasurably more, get this, than you could ever ask or imagine. See, that would be nice to go tell Philip, hey man, trust him here and ask him, invite, don't get frustrated, ask Jesus to say, I don't know how to solve this. I feel insufficient in my own power to be able to take care of these things. And then you hear the echoes of like Luke chapter 18 where they're talking about salvation, and they go, "Who in the world could ever be saved? It sounds like it's a something we could never get done." And Jesus says, "What's impossible with man is possible with God." It's worth, as you read through this, asking yourself, "What would it look like, Lord?" And to ask God to help you to move from that place of relying on you may be really capable of solving a lot of life's problems, but why not take everything, whether it's something easy for you to solve or not, and ask, invite God in to do more than even what you think you're capable of doing, but all the more in situations where you know you're inadequate to solve the problems that you face in life. So other people are listening to this conversation. Verse 8 tells us another one of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. And he said, here's a boy. Look what he's got. He's got these five small barley loaves, and he's got two fish. If you could be to Sunday school, you probably know that little tune. I'll spare you. I won't sing it for you. But he's even doesn't know. He's like, here you go. But I don't know what can be done with all of this. There's something cool here about Andrew that is, I think, so commendable about life to remember. Andrew first shows up in the book of John way back in chapter 1. And Andrew meets Jesus, and his first inclination isn't to like hoard all that Jesus has for himself. But what does it tell us he does? It says that he's one of the first people to follow Jesus. In verse 41, the first thing Andrew did, what does he do? He goes to find his brother Simon, and he tells him, "We found the guy." And that word Messiah, it meant king. We found the person that we've been waiting for, that our nation's been longing for. And what does he do? He says, I want you to come to him. He doesn't just tell him about Jesus. He says, you come to him. See, this is sort of like Andrew's great disposition. He brings the boy with the fish and the barley loaves to Jesus. And this was like his MO, to bring people to Jesus. Would it be great to be known as someone who brought their resources and they brought people to Jesus? Goes on to say, Jesus said to him, he says, "Hey, get the people together, have them sit down." And notice this, it says that there was plenty of grass in that place, and they all sat down. And this is where you get that number, about 5,000 people were there. So Jesus took the loaves. What did he do? He gave thanks, and he passed it out to those who were seated, and they had as much as they wanted. You catch the connection here to another time where Jesus regularly did this, but there's another time that we'll celebrate just a little while here, where Jesus would take bread, right? He'd give thanks, and he'd distribute it to his friends before they feasted on it. And notice when God gives us what we need, it's always everything that we need, and most of the time we find out that it's even more. So it says, he did the same thing with the fish, and when they all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over." He says, "Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them all together, and they filled, 12 baskets, which is this picture of, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel. 12 is a number of completeness in the Bible. And so they get way more than they even needed, a complete number. And they bring back the pieces of the five barley loaves left over from everybody who had eaten them. So if you are a student of the Old Testament, one of the things that you notice as you read through the life of Jesus is very often you feel like, isn't these stories about Jesus sort of like ripping off these stories in the Old Testament? And if you think that, you would actually be correct, because that is what happens regularly, and there's a good reason for this. And I'll show you just a quick example here. Notice how this story echoes this story from 2 Kings chapter 4, where it's talking about Elisha. Now, Elisha and Elijah, two different people, Elijah and Elisha, they were the people that were alive during Jesus' time. They look back to those guys and they go, they were the great miracle workers. They did these incredible things. Who could ever be better than them? Who could do more than what they did? Well, that's the point here, is those stories are doubled and tripled and maxed out down on to say, you think those guys were great? Look at Jesus. It says, a man came from Baal Shalash. I don't know how you say that. He came from somewhere. He says, bring the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread baked from the first ripe grain, along with some heads of new grain. And he says, give it to the people to eat. Does this at all ring a bell? Does it all sound familiar to you? It should, right? Elisha said, he says, how can I set this before 100 men, right? There's no way that I can feed these people with just this much bread. It's not going to happen. His servants ask him this question, but Elisha answered him. He says, get the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says. What does God do? He says, they'll eat and they'll have some left over. Gosh, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? So he sets it before them and they ate and they what? They had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. So these people, they look back at what Elijah and Elisha did and they're like, oh my gosh, these guys were incredible. Who could ever do something greater than them? And see, that's the point of some of these replicated, like way overdone miracles, is to say, you think those guys were great? Look at this Jesus. God worked in and through those prophets, but Jesus himself does this stuff. It's not just Elijah and Elisha, but if you pay attention closely to the New Testament, it paints this picture that the greatest teacher or lawgiver in the Old Testament was Moses. And especially the first five chapters of Matthew all explain this really well, that Jesus is very much like Moses, only he's greater than the person that you esteem as this great lawgiver. If you download your notes from our website, I have all the stuff in there. You can go back and look at it. So the story closes by saying this. It says, after the people saw the signs Jesus performed, they began to say, what's their reaction to this? See, they got it. They understood Jesus is... Moses sat down and Moses recited the law that God gave him to tell the people. Jesus gave us a whole new law himself on a mountain, right? They get this, that Jesus is greater than Moses. He's greater than Elijah and Elisha. Way more incredible what this guy has done. They get it. They say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world that Moses talked about in the Old Testament. Jesus knowing, here's Jesus sees what's coming. This is just like he knew what he was going to do to solve the problem of the people that were hungry. Jesus knows what's coming. He knows that the people are going to be so impressed, they're going to get this stuff, and they want to, by force, make him king. And what does he do? He withdrew again to a mountain by himself. And Jesus knows he's going to be a king. But that's not the way, it's not by the people's adulation that's going to make him, it's not the power of the people installing him. It's going to be his power of giving his life that's going to install him as king. I want to close by sharing communion with you here. And I hope that I can give you a way to help illustrate something that I think is just really easy to forget. Because I think as modern readers, we read these stories and we don't like fully appreciate what it would have been like to be these people. So it tells us, you know, in Matthew and Luke that Jesus is getting away with his disciples. He goes over to the other side of the lake because he wants to get away with them. Everywhere Jesus goes, there's this crush of people. And it's clear, John the Baptist has died. He's sent out the 12. He needs to spend some time just with these guys. He goes over to the other side of the lake, but they can't get enough of him. So Jesus leaves. They typically would leave very early in the morning because that's when the lake was the calmest, and they'd go over. That's the easiest time to travel. So they probably went over there, got over there early, late morning, very, very early afternoon by the time they got up there. And the people know where he's going, and they all travel over there. Now, if they left early in the morning, they probably would have gotten over there very early afternoon, 12, 1 o'clock. And there's this problem right there, right away. People have walked 9 miles at least from the closest places where they can get food. And especially that many people, they can't even go back just to Capernaum. No one town in that area could have fed all these people. There's a major problem here. Now, you think about this. Probably some of the people packed food with them, but not everybody. And so Jesus and the other stories tell us this. He's filled with compassion because he knows these people have this, they're going to have this physical issue. If he's going to sit and spend any time with them, teach them at all, it's going to be late in the day, hard for them to get back. And Jesus, he doesn't treat people like they're an interruption to his plans to get rest. I just marvel at how he's always willing. The only reason he gets away is because he doesn't want them to make him king on their timetable. But, you know, he's compassionate. And he knows they're going to have this very real physical hunger. And he's going to meet the need. You and I, just, and I know this is true of every person that's watching this today. We don't like discomfort. We don't like pain. Most of us will do absolutely everything we can to make sure we have the resources we need so that we're not in any sort of discomfort, even if that means going to the grocery store and snatching up the last of the toilet paper because we're afraid we'll run out and, oh my gosh, that would be horrible for us, wouldn't it? We don't look forward to pain as people. And most of us really, it's difficult for most of us to remember the last time we were like really, really hungry. Because, you know, we have enough food typically, you know, in storage or in our refrigerator to feed us and our family for several days. Most of these people, they knew what hunger was like, and it was an everyday issue that they lived with because they didn't have the resources that we take for granted every day in our lives. Hunger was a real issue for them. They didn't know. They couldn't plan that many days ahead for their livelihoods and their meals. So, I mean, think about how crazy this is. When Jesus prays his prayer, he teaches his disciples to pray, and he says, you know, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And he goes through all that, and he gets the part about food, and he says what? Give us today our daily bread. You and I, you think about how crazy that is for us to pray? Because we've got food enough for days. But they didn't. And that's why they say, give us, God, we need you. We know we're dependent on you to help meet this very real physical need in our life. They understood what physical hunger was like, and I think in a capacity that you and I take for granted. And because we take that for granted, I think that there's also this deep connection to not only physical hunger, but to recognizing spiritual hunger. And they understood both, I think, in a capacity it's difficult for us to understand. So some of you may know this name, Dr. Paul Brand, and here he is, where he spent a large portion of his professional career, which was all of his professional career, he worked with poor people in rural areas of America, but most of it was in India. He became famous because he's the first person who really figured out that leprosy wasn't a tissue disease, but a nerve disease, the deadening of your nerves. And that's why when you get cuts or you touch something too hot and you didn't know it, that would affect your tissue. You had no knowledge that what was going on. You couldn't even feel the infection that you were getting. He's the first person to put all that together. And so he came to recognize the greatest gift he could give to other people was to help them experience pain because it would save their physical bodies. And so he was very innovative at helping restore people's feeling in their extremities. He wrote a book years later. It first was published called Pain, The Gift That No One Wants. That's a great title, isn't it? But people weren't buying the book, and so they rebranded the book, and they called it The Gift of Pain. And he had another really popular writer, Philip Yancey, help write some of the stuff, and it became a bestseller. But he writes this about pain. This is so good. Notice what he says. He says, I thank God for pain. I can't think of a greater gift I could give to people, to my leprosy patients. He says, most people view pain as the enemy. And I think that if you want to be honest, I do. I assume most of you don't look forward to pain. But check this out. He says, yet without it, think about the physical issues, heart attacks, strokes, ruptured appendices, and stomach ulcers. What they would all occur without any warning. The warning signs is what sends you to the doctor so those things don't take your physical life away. Those pains are actually very, very beneficial to us. And in one of my devotionals I read regularly recently, put this connection together between physical pain and spiritual pain and how they work together. And Sky Gitani says this. He says, the gift of pain, it's that God allows us to experience pain so that we can seek healing. See, it's discomfort. It is the discomfort that motivates us to address evil and to bring about change in the world, but also in our life. Spiritual hunger, I think, works in several ways, but just three simple ways that you can think about is one, I think most people that are really in touch with what's going on in their heart and their head and their relationships with other people is we recognize that there things we wish things could be better, richer in our relationship, both with God. We sense that it's just not the way. Surely this can't be the way God intended for the world to be. And we recognize the brokenness. Everybody recognizes the brokenness of our relationships. And we long for things to be richer. And that's the way God originally intended it to be. But that's the problem of rebellion and sin, is it breaks our relationship with God and other people. And that's that. It's a spiritual thing that God put in us, not just a physical thing. But this is a spiritual hunger to be more connected to God and other people. And who doesn't want to have the sense that it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter if you're a plumber or a missionary, whatever you do in life, everybody wants to think that their life actually matters in some sense more than just, I get up each morning, I make my lunch, I go to work, or whatever you do, your routine is, you want to know that your life was meant to mean something in the world, that God had a purpose for you. And that's the longing that God puts in us. And it's what his purpose for each one of us is different, but it's when we discover him and we learn to work for him wherever we are, whatever we're doing, that we can start to quench that desire and recognize that our lives, everyone, every single one of you, you're not an accident. God created you with your unique set of gifts and talents because he wants you to contribute to the world right where you are. In a capacity that nobody else can. That's why he created you. And who doesn't want to know that there's something beyond just this? Those are the spiritual hungers that we have that sometimes we suppress, push away, try and fill with other things. But those are the things that God created us. You eat whenever you get hungry. And most of us eat more than once a day. God created that same physical hunger to be satisfied, not once a week by going to church, but every day, those longings to feast on God and what he offers us. And we can connect with God every day because of the gift of the Holy Spirit that he's given us. Jesus came, he lived, he taught, he died, he was buried, he was resurrected. He ascended to heaven and sends the Holy Spirit so that we can continue to feast on the richness of him in our lives every day. That's why we've talked with you the last couple of days about surrender and examine and how important it is to meet with God in the morning, think about where he was alive and at work in your life throughout the day. It's a gift to be able to feast on God every day. And that's what you're going to find out later on in this chapter. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. So I hope you got communion elements and So these come because Jesus, on his last night with his good friends, he had this meal. And guess what the meal was? It was the Passover meal, the story of rescue and provision that God has made for us. And that's what they would celebrate. And that's what Jesus, he took the bread and he broke it. He gave thanks. He passed it out to his friends. And he says, do this in remembrance of me. That's what we do together. Father, thank you that in a real way, just like physical bread satisfies a physical hunger in our life, feasting on you, your teachings, your word, and your presence in our life can satisfy, and it's the only thing that was meant to satisfy our spiritual hunger. Thanks that you are a rich provision for us to feast on every day. Likewise, Jesus took a cup. He passed it around to his friends. And he says, this is my blood poured out for you. And we do this thinking about the provision and the sacrifice that Jesus made for us to be able to enjoy the rich life that we have. And I tell you, I can't wait to be able to do this together with all of you in here. But I hope that you enjoy remembering the rich life and the rescue that God provided for us. God, you're good, and you are more than enough to meet all of our needs. Thanks for your love for us. Thanks for your word. The way it helps not only help us read what's true about you, but it also gives us the opportunity to read more about ourselves and find out what it means for us to be able to connect with you. We love you, and we thank you for all you've done for us. In Jesus' name, amen. Sierra Community Church, we miss you. God bless you. Thanks for meeting with us today.